Can Your Beans Do That? By Cedric Shannon. Hello everyone, this is the next installment on scale. And we began several episodes ago about scale, and particularly as when it's brought to bear on regenerative agriculture, and typically used as an argument against it in that, that's all well and good what you do, that's nice, but it's not realistic, it can't feed the world. And so I began to argue against that, in that saying that those were false assumptions, or the false assumptions being that, one, conventional agriculture could actually feed the world, which I argued it couldn't, particularly if we look at parameters a little bit long term. And second, I argued that feeding the world was not its mandate, not its purpose, and that actually its technologies, its processes, its whole paradigm was born in a time of war, born in order to be used as a weapon, used as leverage. And so moved on from there to another episode where we talked about the limits of linearity. And I went to John Vervaeke, who does a really good job of explaining the problem space, right? He talks about how when we're even trying to, you know, contemplate the smallest problem, we don't actually use linear processing all that much. We use it within parameters, but that by itself, it's very inadequate. It's actually impossible to get anything done and to think through anything that way, because there's so many variables, it gets so complex, it becomes combinatorially explosive. And so his argument actually is that to avoid this problem space, to avoid that combinatory explosivity, is actually what true intelligence is about. We moved on to Taleb. He kind of got it at from the different angle of predicting, right? So billiard balls, and he made the point that by the time you get to the 56th impact, in order to be precise, you would have to take into account all the particles of the universe, right? Because then they would have a significant impact on the outcome of your prediction. So, and again, it was to explain, to point out that how as things get complex, it becomes exponential, it becomes explosive, and that linear processing is just not up to the task of doing these things, right? So then I brought in Chesterton, and basically showing that we tend to cling to these linear processes, but we do so to our own detriment. Right, we do so as only we become mad. Right, he used the phrase that poetry, it floats on the sea, right, on the infinite sea, but reason, right, reason is trying to cross the infinite sea, trying to make it infinite, and the result is mental exhaustion. Right, you become mad, and so not giving up that linearity, not realizing that there's some other elements at work, some other faculties of the mind, actually leads you to become mad, right? So that's why he gets into the madness and the tight circles, and that you can't reason people out of their madness, because it's actually the organ of thought that is diseased. It's stuck in a circular rut, and it goes round and round, and what you're not going to be able to get it out through logic, because their logic makes sense within their paradigm, within the premises that they've already accepted. Right. And I had put this all in the context of left brain, right brain, and Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary, where the left brain is that which is really good. When you give it your paradigms, give it the limited amount of variables, it uses logic and reason and gets stuff done. But that the right brain is that part which is open to the new, which is able to see the big picture. It's able to see a fresh new paradigm. It's able to gestalt, right? And so what we're getting at here is that there's something else involved other than linearity, other than reasoning, other than logic that has to come to play. That faculty of mind has to be something else, right? And that's when Verveke brings in his relevance realization. There's something that is able to realize what the relevant variables are in order for us to then, you know, use our reasoning, our logic, our, you know, our ability to think through things that way, right? And so Chesterton is very clear, right? The logical reasoning gets us in trouble all the time. There's something else. And there's something else that is, well, to a modern typical person, it's a little bit, sounds a little wishy-washy, because he calls it a leap of faith, right? It's very Kierkegaardian. It's a leap of will. It's a leap of intuition. It involves imagination. So today, as we get into scale and what scale actually looks like, I'm gonna pull from all these things. I'm very Kierkegaardian in that way, right? I studied, I had an upper level class of philosophy in Kierkegaard, and we studied his epistemology. He actually had spheres that he believed. We saw the world through different paradigms, and he had different spheres. But that as you were progressing, as you were maturing, as you were growing, he stressed that there was a discontinuity. Right? It wasn't linear. You couldn't go by it incrementally. You couldn't achieve this new paradigm. You couldn't get to this new sphere of seeing the world through more mature eyes through a linear process. For him, it was very important, that leap. It was a leap of faith, and it involved a death, right? Something that really felt like death. You were giving up your processes. It was scary as hell, and you had to try to embrace an entire new set of processes, and all at once. It's a big gestalt, right? It's a leap from one to another. And I remember there was a quote from him that just stuck with me through the years. It was, "The leap from which water turns to ice." And it, you know, it was years and years later that came back to me, and realizing that this was actually a very very apt metaphor. Water was a very apt metaphor to talk about scale. And so I wanted to bring it as a model, right? We tend to think of scale linearly, but nature has, that's not the way nature works, right? And so thinking of water, I want to provide a model here that stresses the discontinuity, that stresses how things change. So if you think about water, is one of those strange things that we get to see in its solid, liquid, and gas form, right? And we know, you take things into the lab, and as you say we take a block of ice and we start adding heat to it, right? And let's keep that heat regular. And so we say, oh, okay, this is really cold ice. We're adding heat. There's a one-to-one relationship, we imagine, between adding that heat and the temperature, going up on thermometer. And that stays true, you know, until we reach a threshold, right? So you start turning from a solid to a liquid, that temperature actually plateaus. It stays relatively flat. There's no longer a linear correlation between the heat that you're putting in and the temperature that registers on the thermometer, right? Because what's happening is it's changing at that threshold. It's changing. We talk about latent energy and kinetic energy, right? But as the temperature very clearly plateaus until the ice has turned to liquid. And then once we're back into that, a new paradigm, so to speak, when we're liquid, we have a one-to-one relationship again. We have linearity kicking in. And so as you go from 0 degrees Celsius all the way up to 100 degrees Celsius, we can count on that linearity. You put this much heat in, the temperature is going to rise. But what happens again? So you get to that threshold, right? You get to that where it starts turning from liquid to gas, and suddenly that temperature plateaus again. And so we have that whole energy changing, you know, into latent and kinetic. And you don't have to get too much into the details. I want to give an overall just view, at one level, that there's these thresholds. And that linearity kicks in and kicks out. that linearity becomes appropriate within certain parameters. And I want to argue, and I want to say that this is a good model for scale, so that when you're in a certain scale, that and we know what processes are at, you know, at play, then we can use those processes, and there's a very linear and straightforward path, right? But that there's these thresholds where that linearity doesn't always apply, right? I remember studying about chaos theory, also in college, and how all these different disciplines were coming to the same conclusion that there was these thresholds, right? And what was really stressed was that, I mean, this was like all these different disciplines, like they were graphing, I think one was the population of butterflies or something, right? And but as they started these graphs, you know, they had their R value, which was equivalent to the heat in the water, which continually is being added to the system. And as that happened, you had thresholds, right? And you would see on the graph, there would be a period where things were very orderly. There was a pattern, you know, and at regular intervals, it bifurcated. It would split into two, and there was just, you could see the whole pattern. And then all of a sudden, as that R value increased, you would hit again another threshold, and suddenly it would all go random. It'd all go chaotic, right? And that would continue for a while. And then you get to this point, and you hit another threshold, and suddenly order would come in again. And so I think water expresses this very well, that there are times when there's linearity and it's straightforward, and then there are times when there are thresholds, when things are a little bit more complicated and we have to resettle and figure out what the different processes are, right? Because as we think about it again, as what's going on at the molecular level. What I'm going to argue, just like with water, is that different scales require different processes. So you have the gas, right? And that tends to be very mechanical, right? Very kinetic. These molecules are bouncing around, bing, bong, bing, bong, and you have a vapor. But as we now instead of heating, right, we're cooling, and we go past the threshold and we go into water, suddenly the molecules are acting very differently. They're not bouncing around near as much, and you have to take into account the actual structure of the molecule, right? You have two hydrogens, you have one oxygen. The hydrogens are the smallest atom, you know, oxygen, relatively speaking, is a lot larger. And so you end up having this V shape, and because you have a V shape with the two smaller ones at one side and the bigger one, which is negative, you have a negative charge down there and a positive charge up top, or at the other side, or the different poles. And so you begin to have interactions between these molecules of the positive and negative charges. And at that level, it's not as much the kinetic and the bouncing around and mechanical, but actually we start getting to electromagnetic processes, right? And then we'll come back to liquid water, but at this point, let's just keep going down. We're getting cooler, and we get to the threshold. We're getting right up to almost to 0 degrees Celsius, and we slow down those molecules even more. And as they slow down as they get into ice, the molecules suddenly lock into place. Those positive and negatives of the water are suddenly locking into place, and they create a diamond shape sort of scaffold. And this scaffold ends up having more space in between the molecules than the liquid does, which is why ice actually is less dense than the liquid, which is partly why life can exist on this earth, and that we can have fish in the sea and survive, you know. But it's a very strange process that happens molecularly, right? Now, so stressing here that we have thresholds, stressing that different linearity kicks in and out depending if we are between thresholds or at the thresholds. And then I'm also stressing that there are different processes at play depending at where we are in the between those thresholds, and applying to scale, right? That there are thresholds and that there are different processes depending on which scale we're at. Now, I do think that liquid water gets more complicated. I've read Gerald Pollack's book on the fourth phase of water and on cells, gels, and the engines of life, if I remember the titles right. But he's arguing that liquid water has sort of two phases. There's one where it's more bulk and more random, and there's one where it's more orderly, right? Again, we see this fractal pattern of order and chaos again. And what happens is that water, as it relates and interacts with other things, such as it could be a hydrophilic surface, such as it could be proteins, or when it has infrared or light affecting it, right? It tends to structure itself. It's a little different structure. It's more hexagonal. It's different than ice, but just like ice, right? Ice, when it gets structured, it pushes out solvents. So does structured water. And as structured water, in its special formation, as it pushes out those solvents and it structures itself in this hexagon scaffold, it actually becomes charged. The water that's structured becomes highly charged negatively, and the bulk water, which is much more random, becomes charged positively. And at this level, at this molecular level, at this scale, at this resolution, this becomes the dominant process at work. And so Pollack's argument is that this is going on at the cellular level all over biology. So this is what helps our this is what how our muscles contract and uncontract. This is how cells fire. This is how neurons of the brain. This is all these things are happening as things are shifting and transitioning between thresholds, between the order and the chaos, between the structured water and non-structured water. In fact, he has this great illustration of how these processes are so essential, right? We're taught generally as, you know, the circulatory system at the very, you know, the basic thing is the heart, right? And the heart is this pump, and it mechanically pumps everything, and it pumps our, you know, takes in blood and it pumps out blood. But the problem is when you do the math on it, and you think about it, and you take all into all the veins, all the arteries, and actually when we get down to the small, tiny capillaries, these are the tiny veins and arteries, and you actually have these tubes, right? Your veins and your arteries, the capillaries, are actually smaller than the red blood cell, which is a decently sized cell. And so you're trying to push these red blood cells through these tiny tubes that are actually smaller than the diameter than the diameter of the red blood cell. So you're pushing these red blood cells through these tubes. And if you were to, that takes an immense amount of force. And when they did the math, and I don't know how you would do this math, but these smart scientists are coming up with saying, oh my goodness, when you do the math like this, the heart really needs to be, I don't know, maybe 100 times, maybe 500, I don't remember, but it needs to be maybe 200 times bigger and stronger than it is to be able to push these red blood cells through these veins. And so what's interesting is that Pollack said, well, structured water explains this beautifully. It's actually much more of a bottom-up emerging process. And so he goes through all these experiments and shows that when you take water and you put it in a tube, and either the tube is hydrophilic, meaning that the water likes it, likes to sort of gravitate to the edges of the tube, or you add water, you add light onto the water begins to structure. And as it structures along the surfaces and whatnot, it creates flow because it creates a negative charge and a positive charge. So much so that you could actually use water and structured water and the bulk water and those two opposing positive and negative, you can use it as a battery. But simply by as water is being structured, as it interacts with proteins, as it interacts with infrared energy, as it interacts with all this, it creates positive and negative charge, and that creates flow, and that actually can now account for the amount of energy that's needed to make our circulatory system work. I think that's beautiful, because we get into the processes of these different scales, and what happens is we ignore these at our own sort of peril, right? I mean, physics recognizes these processes all the time at these larger scales, right? We, as just normal day-to-day life, we tend to be a little bit more Newtonian, right? What we can see and feel and smell and whatever, just we understand more Newtonian. There's force and there's inertia and there's friction and there's, you know, you hit something and momentum, right? But as we scale up, even though it's harder for understand, we now pretty much know that at the planetary level, the process that's more important is not the mechanical as much as gravitation, right? And then you get even bigger than that, and suddenly we're dealing with the relativity, you know, of light and space and time and bending space and all this, right? It gets really complicated. Different processes are at work, or, you know, then you get, or you get smaller, you get more micro, right? We get into the cellular level, we have the positive and negative, we have ions, we have cations, we have, you know, electrons, and we have oxidation with the, you know, free radicals and cascading electrons, you know, all this different stuff that you get into your chemistry. And then even below that, we have processes that we are now, physics is exploring the quantum level, right? And things get really weird there, right? We have electrons that are flitting in and out of existence. You know, we can't pinpoint its velocity or its location at the same time. We have concepts like superposition, and we have entanglement, right? We have suddenly, right? It becomes different processes at different scales. Right? And this becomes important, because when we build our systems, we don't usually take into account this nonlinearity, this discontinuity, right? It would be like we're building, say we wanted to build an artificial circulatory system, right? And if we just purely are thinking about it mechanically, we'll build this heart and we'll build this, you know, this equivalent where we have this pump and it's pushing things out. And, you know, maybe we have a really simple sort of setup where we have this pump and it has a few pipes and it circulates, right? And we're able to have a pump that's able to do that, right? And at that scale, okay, mechanics is enough. But now suddenly we get more complex. Suddenly we get something that's complex as a human body. And if we were going to try to, like, have a heart be strong enough to do what, you know, what we thought it was doing mechanically, right, we're going to have to build the heart as big as the body in order to have that, right, in order to be able to make it work, right? So ignoring the processes leads us down bad avenues, so to speak, right? But we tend to do this in our systems, right? Especially in our economic systems, right? We have, I think of the colloquial word to scale, right? Typically, we, you know, if someone's starting a business and they say, well, look what I made this thing, one, you know, and very intelligent people are going to come and help them out, and inevitably you'll hear, so does your model scale? And what they're meaning basically is that, do your processes that you're using right now to make whatever you're making or to accomplish whatever you're accomplishing, can you use those processes to make a lot more, right? Can you increase production? Can you now ramp up the amount of quantity without changing your processes? That, we say, is scaling, and that's a good business model, right? So we have like Wall Street where, right? It's all like computer and technological, and we have software. You could go on a site and be like, oh, I want to buy or sell 5 shares, right? And you just put in your number and you click a button, right? It's going to be the exact same process as if you decided you were going to do 50 or 500 shares, right? It's a linear process. It's the same process. It's this, you know, it doesn't matter the number. And that, we think, is a good way to scale. But that's not the way that nature scales. In fact, it's very dangerous to scale that way. And one person who I think is good at understanding this is Talib. And he talks about in the Black Swan about extremistan and mediocristan. And he says, mediocristan is that world of kind of flesh and bone and reality, and you're just physical and you try to scale things up. You know, say you have a trades job or you're a dentist, whatever, and you need to scale up. You're gonna have to buy more things, and you have more people, and there's all these very physical constraints on how you can scale up. Whereas technology tends to scale in ways that doesn't have these limits, right? And so you can get what he calls extremistan, right? So you get these feedback loops, and they just go out of control, and suddenly, right? He uses the musician, right? Like now we have digital, or whether it's social media or whatever it is, right? It just kind of gets its own feedback loop, and the popular get more popular. And so we have those people take, it's a winners take all, basically, arena, right? And so we're trying to do we're trying to create these models of scale, and we scale technologically, and there's all kinds of consequences, right? There's consequences of winner take all, basically, is exactly why the reason that we have such a disparity of wealth, the reason why the amount of people who are, it's just shrinking and shrinking, the amount of people who have half the wealth of the globe is becoming a smaller and smaller group of people, is because of our technologies. And because we scale in this linear way, there are no restraints, right? And conventional agriculture is doing the exact same thing. Just like we're trying to like we want to make a circulatory system, and we make this pump, and we just keep making this heart bigger and bigger and bigger, and not realizing that there's all these other smaller, intricate processes at play, right? We take the concept of a garden where we have one bed here of green beans, and we have a couple beds here of tomatoes, and a couple over here of squash, and we try to increase that. Right? Now suddenly we will try to make an acre of everything, and maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. Then we go 10 acres, 100 acres, 500 acres, and suddenly we have these massive things that we're trying to scale, trying to use the same processes, trying to champion efficiency, and we have these massive monocultures. And what happens is that we have these drastic ecological disaster because of it. But we are like the madman, right? We are like that madman who won't let go of his reasoning and just keeps pushing it up the scale, right? And so we start, right? If you believe that you're the King of England, is to write the Chesterton's example, you're going to interpret everything like that. So when someone says, you shouldn't worry about that, whatever, they're going to interpret that you're on this conspiracy, right? I once knew a guy, he's dead now, but I can't quite call him a friend, but I interacted with him quite a lot. He was in the neighborhood, and we played soccer together, and every now and then he would call me. He would call me one time in the middle of the night, and he was just distraught, right? And he fully believed he had a chip in his head that the government was telling him all these things, and telling him all these really weird things. And if you even remotely suggested that maybe something else was going on, possibly there could be schizophrenia, or maybe you could get some help, he would just immediately assume that you were in on the conspiracy, and that you were probably behind the radio that was telling him these weird things in the middle of the night, or even during the day, right? So stuck, he's holding on to this one way of seeing the world, holding on to this premise. And that's what agriculture does, conventional agriculture. We fully believe in efficiency. So we're going to make all our technology, we're going to make these massive machines. And in order to be able to use that, we keep taking away variables. We keep simplifying things. We have to take away as much diversity as we can, right? We'll have these 100 acres, and we want to make sure we have the exact same species that we're growing, only one species, hopefully exactly the same variety of that crop. We want it the same age, and we want it to all have grown the same height, so as we come and bring our machine through, right, we can harvest it more easily, and it'll be really efficient, right? And we ignore all of everything else. We ignore all the damage we're doing to the soil. We ignore all the damage we're doing to ecology. We ignore even the fact that it's getting more expensive to grow it this way. We ignore the fact that it's becoming less and less nutritious, right? We sacrifice everything for the single variable. And that's that sort of logical, linear, right? It's that left brain versus right brain, right? And to bring it back to McGilchrist, I would like to read a short passage from his master and his emissary. And this is where he's talking about scale, and he's talking about how the left hemisphere is unable to understand, unable to give up its processes in order to understand scale, and wants to hold on to that linearity. And so he's talking about the Sorites paradox. This is an older paradox from way back when. I don't know exactly when, but it's the idea that the guy asks the question, some philosopher, and he's like, okay, so we take a grain of sand and we add a grain of sand, and then we add another one, and then we add another one, add another one. At what point does it turn into a heap, right? And he says, like, what number is it, right? He's pointing out, like, it gets absurd, right? Is it at 5,432 grains of sand? Is that when it turns to a heap? And it magically, at 531, it's not a heap, and then at 5,332, it is a heap, or whatever, you know. So McGilchrist is saying, like, what's going on in the brain? And he says, this results from believing that the whole is the sum of the parts, and that it can be reached by a sequential process of incrementation. It tries to relate two things, a grain of sand and a heap, as though their relationship was transparent. It also presupposes that there must either be a heap or not be a heap at any one time. Either or are your only alternatives. That is the left hemisphere view, and sure enough, it leads to paradox. According to the right hemisphere view, it is a matter of a shift in context and the coming into being of a gestalt, an entity which has imprecisely defined bounds and is recognized whole. The heap comes into being gradually and is a process, an evolving, changing thing. Failure to take into account context, inability to understand gestalt forms, an inappropriate demand for precision where none can be found, and ignorance of process, which becomes a never-ending series of static moments. These are signs of left hemisphere predominance. Right, so we're talking about different ways of approaching systems, right? And when we're approaching scale, right, we every time we're doing it linearly, we're actually setting ourselves one for failure or else for crazy amount of disaster, whether ecologically, whether socially, right, or whether whatever, all other kinds of, you know, second, third order effects that we can't even think about, right? I want to get another quote in here while I'm quoting. It's also Nicholas Taleb, but this time it's from his book Skin in the Game. And I think he has a real good sense of scale and what's going on. He says, groups are units on their own. There are qualitative differences between a group of 10 and a group of, say, 395,435. Each is a different animal, in the literal sense, as different as a book is from an office building. When we focus on commonalities, we get confused. But at a certain scale, things become different, mathematically different. The higher the dimension, in other words, the higher the number of possible interactions, and the more disproportionately difficult it is to understand the macro from the micro, the general from the simple units. I think both McGilchrist and Taleb are recognizing the discontinuity, right? The fact that he would say that scale is the difference between a book and an office building, the difference between a grain of sand and a heap. This is precisely, I'm arguing, is the difference between basically ice and water as a liquid and water as vapor. They're very qualitatively different. And if we keep building our systems linearly, as in scale, we end up with all kinds of problems, right? And so agriculture is a perfect example of that, right? Where we keep trying to use these, it's all about efficiency. We've completely thrown resilience out of it. We've completely thrown health. We've completely thrown the wild. We've completely thrown nutrition. We've completely thrown all the dynamics and of the things that are going at the scale of the soil. We've thrown it all out, right? And we do this in other areas too. I think when we come back to water and we think of it in terms of beaver dams, right? If we think of the water cycles as a whole, we think of the water cycle going from the ocean and part of that being, you know, comes up into the atmosphere. And then as it turns into vapor, part of that's going onto the land and being dropped onto the land. And then eventually that fresh water works its way from the land back into the ocean. Well, what is essential for life, what is essential for ecosystems, what is essential for biology is for that water to be slowed down, for that water to start getting into the ground, being drawn up into living beings and being cycled all over the place. And eventually it'll work its way through all these different systems and get back to the ocean. But the more systems it can cycle through, the more complex things can get, the more life can be supported. So in that context, a beaver dam is doing an amazing and important thing, right? The beaver doesn't know what he's doing. He just loves to chew on trees and make dams. But what happens is that slows the water down. And that water then becomes available for all kinds, a multitude of diversity of vegetation. And it creates habitat for frogs and insects and salamanders, and it works really well. The salmon have no problem navigating these things, and it keeps the waters healthy and slow enough that, you know, they can go upstream, right? And in our sort of linear scale technology mindset, we go ahead and we build a hydroelectric dam. Massive ones, right? Ones that are so big, like we're using clean energy. We're using water power to generate electricity. And we create these massive, huge dams as if they have a linear connection to beaver dams. But these massive dams, you can ask the salmon, right? They are not helping life. They are not supporting life the way that beaver dams are. And that's because beaver dams don't scale into bigger dams, right? A book, as it scales, doesn't scale into just more and more books, right? Taleb is arguing it scales into something qualitatively different, as in an office building. Right? A grain of sand doesn't just go into bigger and bigger piles of grains. It becomes a heap, right? Water turns, ice turns to liquid, turns to ice. So a beaver dam doesn't scale into a massive Hoover dam, right? And I would argue that a beaver dam scales into riparian health, right? It scales into this vast complex system that involves retaining the water, involves all the, you know, supporting all this life, right? And as we've gotten rid of the beavers, right, as we hunted them and we got rid of them, there used to be millions of them, and now there's very few of them, our rivers begin to reflect our linearity. I think, again, this is another really apt metaphor of linearity. Our rivers become faster and faster. They aren't being slowed down by these dams. They start carving. They erode deeper and deeper caverns. So the water not only is not being used for supporting life and vegetation and everything, but it's going down faster and faster back towards the ocean, trying to finish its cycle faster and faster, right? And that's that feedback loop. It becomes harder and harder to dam, right? And it carves it deeper and deeper so that that water is not being used by life. And so we have this sort of, I think, a really apt metaphor of what linearity happens when it gets out of control, and that it's this water rushing down without being slowed down and being able to be used by a multitude of all these different systems to support life. And so the things I'm trying to stress here are, one, that there's thresholds, and that at those thresholds, it's important that the processes and the dynamics, the technologies, the ways that we think have to come to a halt, right? There are limits to that linearity, and those thresholds force those limits. And if we try to, in a sense, force the linearity through that scale, we do so at great, great cost. We harm ourselves, and we harm societies, and we harm the earth, and we harm ecosystems. And so what happens is we're forced to go back to that, okay, so if we can't depend on our logic, we can't depend, it's not linear, right? There's something else that's going to have to guide us through these gestalts, guide us through these thresholds, guide us through these very discontinuous leaps onto different scales, right? And that gets back to the relevance realization. And so if we have relevance realization that's dependent on other things than reasoning in terms of logic and linearity, we're talking about imagination and intuitions. And there's a very scary, to me, it's a very scary thought that as we have the population of the earth is becoming, now it's dominantly urban, it's being influenced, it's being taught, basically our imaginations, our intuitions are being taught and influenced by a virtual world, right? Most people live in cities of concrete. They have no connection to the earth. They have no connection to, they're getting their food at grocery stores, all wrapped up in plastic and much of the food they're buying has been processed out of recognition of what it originally was, right? We have entire populations that don't know the rhythms of nature. They don't try to live within seasons. They just, right? This informs our intuitions. This informs our imaginations. And that's a scary thought, because that says, when we're trying to navigate this extremely dangerous, extremely scary leap that we need to face, right? Kierkegaard would say we're going to have to die, and we're going to have to embrace these new processes all at once in a gestalt, right? What's going to guide us? What's going to lead us? How are we going to know how to leap to and what to, right? This is our faculties of reason. And now we have a world dominated by a worldview of Legos, a worldview of parts, of reductionism. We even have a huge section of our population of intelligent people believing in determinism, that we don't even have a choice, that cause and effect is everything, right? That anything that you consider as deeper, like love and joy and peace and kindness, all these things, that's just, I can describe that. That's just, dopamine and, serotonin and oxy, whatever, all these, right? There's all these explanations anymore, and we have completely reduced the world to mechanical processes or chemical processes or whatnot. And we are in serious danger of not being able to navigate. In fact, we're already showing how we build our systems. We build our systems, and we scale our systems very linearly, very technologically. And now we're stuck here with the results, and we don't know what to do, right? We have all these byproducts of our systems that are destroying ecosystems. We're making fewer and fewer filthy rich, impoverishing the rest of the people, and we're becoming less and less healthy. So where does that leave us? I know I'm not the only one who feels like civilization is coming to a head, that we're approaching the cusp of something very big, a threshold of change, and that we're arriving at the climax, at the conclusion of the internal paradox of our systems. And we need a change, we need a gestalt. And so we're looking for assurances. And in our linear tendencies, in looking for these assurances, we say, run the numbers, right? We want a linear, we don't want a leap. We don't want to die and take that leap of faith, right? We want to run the numbers, right? And I'm saying, no, this is the very same logic of the original question. Right? I know you're doing right by the land, and I know you're doing a good thing, but run the numbers and you're not going to feed the world, right? As if you could feed the world and not do it by doing right by the land and right by people, right? You can't have a system that is like destroying the earth, destroying communities, destroying, polluting the airs, polluting the waters, destroying this, destroying all the ecosystems around. And using it, as a weapon of war, and then say suddenly, oh, we're going to use this system and we're going to run the numbers so we can feed the world. It doesn't work like that. So essentially, I'm arguing for morality has to be, we have it has to have integrity, moral integrity at all scales, right? Now, this is easier for animals in the sense that animals just do what they do, right? They've found their niches, right? They've evolved into them, right? So like a beaver has teeth and wants to gnaw trees and loves to play in water and build dams. And out of this, just beaver being a beaver, this beautiful repair, thing happens, poof, gestalts into this, healthy water systems of fertility. Right? Cows and ruminants in big groups eating grass. They just do it. And phew, this beautiful thing of building soil happens, right? Wolves preying and eating deer are helping the rivers, like at Yellowstone, right? So I guess the question becomes, what is our equivalent of this? How do we, get ourselves back into a natural niche? Right? I mean, if we're talking about left brain, right brain, right? And we have an entire society that just keeps increasing the left brain. The right brain, to nurture the right brain, we have an idea of things, the sort of nonlinear things that are good to nurture it, right? We talk about music and art and relationships and communities, but above all else, right? Is nature and the biological systems around us. That's what nurtures and helps us have the right instincts to recognize the true patterns and the appropriate and the relevant patterns that need to be at play. Right? But now we have over half of the world is now the population of the world is living in cities, right? Everyone's got cell phones. Technology is everywhere. All our relationships, all these right brain things are now being brokered by technology. Whether it's a cell phone, right? Whether it's Facebook, whether it's social media, all this stuff, right? It's everything is leaning. It's a catch-22. It's all leaning towards, it's getting a feedback loop of just encouraging the left brain and on this linear thinking, this technological thinking. And so as we're coming to this threshold and we need these instincts to move forward into something that's better and healthier, we want to do it linearly, right? And we want to do it through technology. And we want to do it through all these things that are getting us in the problem in the first place. And I'm arguing until, and this is distilling a lot of thought into a small area, but we have to find, in a sense, our niche, our natural niche again. We have to get reconnected, literally have to get our bodies reconnected to the earth. I'm not, whether it's the biome, whether it's the, food you eat, whether it's getting your hands literally in the dirt, whether it's experiencing the seasons. I mean, we have got to get out of our virtual world. We have got to stop brokering every relationship, whether it's with other people or the earth or whatever, through technology. We have to get back to meaning. We have to recapture all those love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, all those good things. That has to be recaptured by experiencing it through relationships, through communities, through nature, and all that. Otherwise, we will never be able to change in a way that's healthy. Thanks for listening.